people would start to reject my answers. They'll be like, oh, where are you from? And I would say, I'm French. And they'll be like, no, you're not French. And I'll be like, okay, I'm Chinese. No, you're not Chinese either. So I remember there was one guard of my building. He kept bugging me about where I'm from. And then he was like, one day I came home and he's like, I know it. You're Vietnamese. I was like, No, I don't think so. I'm fully, you know, I know my parents and all this is like, okay, your grandmother is Vietnamese.
Welcome to Proudly Asian, a podcast series that tells bold and proud stories of Asians by Asians. My name is Isabel, your podcast host, and I'm here to find stories that challenge biases we face every day. There's never just one way to look at Asians. This podcast will take you through a deep dive into the life stories, struggles, and triumphs of young Asians around the world. On today's episode, we have Cathy Shan, a French Polynesian interior designer who is the founder of Hong Kong design studio Atelier Shan. Born and raised in Tahiti, Cathy has studied in France and is the former principal architect of Soho House Hong Kong. She joins us to talk about her experience growing up in French Polynesia and her career journey as an interior designer. Welcome back to Proudly Asian. Now, perhaps you're wondering, where are we? We will find out a little bit more about where we are filming on location for this episode very soon. It might be a bar, it might be a Cha Chan Teng in Hong Kong. We don't know yet, but we're going to find out very soon. And sitting right next to me now is the interior designer behind this very cool space that we are filming from today. So welcome to Proudly Asian, Cathy.
Thank you
so much for joining us on the show. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for having me, Isabel. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Yes, me too. Because as some of our listeners might know, they might find out through the intro of the episode that you are from French Polynesia and you're the first guest from French Polynesia for us. So we are so curious about your experience growing up there and also, you know, how your family ended up there and everything,
how on earth.
And also the story behind this space that we are filming
Yes, I'm ready.
Yes. So now, I mean, of course, we will get started with a set of questions that we ask every single guest of ours on Proudly Asian, which is, Cathy, tell us about your background. Who are you? What are you? And where did you grow up?
Tough question. I can't answer this with one sentence only. I'll have to like elaborate a little bit. Sometimes I even ask the question back, but because we don't have so much time, you wouldn't figure out. But so I'm Cathy Shan. I have an interior design studio based in Hong Kong. We opened it in 2019 and started with Hong Kong, a lot of commercial spaces, interior designs. And now we have some projects in Indonesia, in the US as well. Our clients like contact us from different parts of the world. Our Hong Kong clients contact us for their other projects elsewhere. So very exciting projects. And I'm from French Polynesia. And the reason why I'm here is also because I'm Asian. I'm Hakka. My family history like comes from the Hakka people in the south of China, so around Shenzhen. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, definitely so curious about your experience growing up in French Polynesia. But I mean, are there any like childhood memories that you can share with us? You know, basically, what was breakfast like? Yeah. Any Asian parents' expectations that you were subjected to?
I mean, that's the really funny, weird thing is that I didn't know we were Asians when we grew up. So obviously, my whole family is Asian, grandma, granddad, like all the grandparents. And we were just being like, it's just a very happy childhood without too many questions or, you know, like crisis, identity crisis yet. But so very, very dreamy childhood when you can imagine. Have you seen Moana?
Yes.
That's how I feel.
Straight out of Moana.
Yes, exactly. Well, we just grew up very connected to nature, and my parents are also very grounded. Like, I think it's very good that we did a lot of outdoor activities as well. And just happy to stay in the garden and play in the garden. And my dad really likes baking. So he would make, we would have really nice breakfast, like pancakes in the weekends, you know. So a lot of childhood memories around food, which I don't know if it's Asian or French or Tahitian, no idea. But anyway, there's a lot of food in our family, food, love for food. Yeah, and then it's always warm and beautiful and the sea is so beautiful. But this we wouldn't know unless we would, until I like visited other cities or lived in France. I didn't realize how special my childhood was. And I also didn't realize how Chinese I was until I left and went to continental France for my studies. And then they were like, yeah, you're Chinese. You know, they were like, why do you speak French? And I was like, well, I'm French.
Yeah.
And so this whole like thing about confusion, are you French or Chinese or Tahitian came, and they're still going on. But at least I'm a little bit more experienced in trying to explain where I'm from.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned growing up, you didn't really think much about whether or not you're Asian.
Yeah.
But did you know that your family had Chinese heritage? Was it something that's pretty much a part of your childhood as
Yes, well? Yes, totally. So we definitely, we knew we're from the Chinese community, but it's a big melting pot, if you want my opinion. Like, I didn't feel like we were so segregated. So there's Tahitian in Tahiti who are the original Polynesians. You can think of it like the Maoris in New Zealand or the indigenous Hawaiians. So there's a big part of the population who's Tahitian. And then there's maybe 13% of French. And then some mixed, French, Tahitian or French, Chinese. And then there's maybe around 7% of Chinese people. So some are Hakka and some are from the ethnicity Han, who are the majority of the Chinese people in China. So yeah, there's a little, it's a big melting pot, and the culture is also really mixed. So we have Tahitian, like the local culture, who is a lot about surfing and cool vibes and, you know, like we don't care about anything and life is good, mixed with LA, like the US vibe.
We're surfer culture.
Very close. Yeah. Like, because a lot of surfers come, there's also surf competition, so there's always Roxy, Quicksilver, Billabong brands out there. And then we are a French country, so we're not a French department, which means we have our own president and our own ministers and rules and all this, but we're just under the umbrella of France. So there's this French influence as well, because all our education, driving licenses, law is French, 100% French.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess like for some of our previous guests, for example, we had a guest from Myanmar, and then he said he would get questions about where is Myanmar? Yeah. What is Myanmar?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you get this kind of question a lot as well about French Polynesia. Whenever you tell people that you're from there, they're like, oh, where is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what is it like? You know, you just mentioned it's kind of like Moana. Are there any like skyscrapers or pretty much like low-rise buildings?
Low-rise, absolutely.
Beaches,
no skyscrapers
everywhere.
No, the highest, like, no, there's really no towers, nothing.
Wow.
Which it's is such flat. A contrast with Hong Kong,
right?
Yeah, but I do, it's flat, but there's like amazing mountains. They're so beautiful, and it's a lot of nature. It's still stunning, you know, like and I'm glad it's still keeping that very nature pure form, because it's just not as developed as Hawaii, if you want to compare. Mm. It's just really down to earth and nature, yeah, kind nice. Of lifestyle.
And
yeah.
it's just a flight away from LA.
Yes, 8 hours only.
8 hours? Yeah. That's so not bad.
When people ask, when I answer, okay, I'm from Tahiti or French Polynesia, either I have only two kind of reaction. The first one is, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, this must be beautiful. Like growing up there, I always wanted to go. And then the second reaction is, oh, okay, where is it? Like they have never heard about it. And then sometime, like maybe 30% would think it's Haiti, which had an earthquake. So then I get a whole other type of questions because it's a different country.
Because they thought like, oh, Tahiti, yeah, it's...
they never heard about it. So they're just, the connection in their brain is just Haiti. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. It sounds like, you know, like sometimes people who are from Hong Kong, they might get asked about, oh, is Hong Kong in Japan?
Exactly. Yeah. So we get the same thing. I get the same thing.
I see. And now going back to your family, right? I'm wondering, you know, what was the immigration history and story of your family? How did they end up in French Polynesia?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's always been, you know, the Hakka people are nomadic, right? So they don't really have land or they're not really a wealthy ethnic. The story of my family in particular was that my great-great-grandfather, so the grandfather of my dad, came to Tahiti to work, maybe in agriculture, like sugarcane or cotton. And at that time, they used to have to take a boat. So it's like maybe 3 months of sailing of boats, I guess. Yeah. It's in the 20s. Let's say we're in the 1920s. And the details are like that. They still had multiple wives. So I'm from the second wife. Like my dad is from the second wife. And so he was doing all this movement of like bringing his first wife, and then he brought his second wife. They had kids in Tahiti. They started to, you know, work, get wealthier. And then my great-grandfather, sorry, I'm like a little bit dyslexic about this word. You'll correct me after. Died. And then so the whole family had, both wives and kids had to go back to China. Mm. And that's where my grandfather learned Chinese and learned how to read and write. But they were really extremely poor. So later on, when he was a bit older, like in his teens, able to work, he went back to Tahiti to work with his brother. And that's when they founded, they had kids themselves, and they started to open a small shop selling groceries, just goods all around, not just Tahiti. So French Polynesia has a few islands. So he was on one of the other islands, not the main ones. And that's where, yeah, my dad was born there as well.
Wow. So your family had a long history in French Polynesia.
Yes. I'm like fourth generation. That's why we really don't have like close family here. Or in Shenzhen, we don't have that, that close relatives. My dad did a trip one day to look at the kind of village where our ancestors were born. Mm-hmm. But that's it, yeah.
But growing up, did you ever wonder, you know, what was Shenzhen like? What was China like?
Not really.
You didn't really only think much
after,
of it.
Yeah, only after, because my sister actually really loves, she's older, she loves China. And she decided to study there. So she's the smart one. She actually is fluent in Mandarin. She learned at school.
Wow.
And she worked then in Beijing and in Shanghai. Yeah.
And that's like she's kind really of fluent. Your connection to China.
And that's when
anything.
I started to visit it. And I was like, okay, this is crazy because I do not understand anything.
That was like a whole world outside of French Polynesia.
Yes, yes.
I mean, since you mentioned your sister now speaks fluent Mandarin, I'm also wondering about, you know, from the languages perspective, what kind of languages are usually spoken in French Polynesia? Oh. And for yourself, how many languages do you speak?
So French Polynesia is definitely, so you have French is the national language, but there's also the original language, which is Tahitian. Mm. And funnily, because of all the different would I say, sailors who came through, like, I don't know, like centuries ago, there were the Dutch and Spanish for a long time. So a few words are really sound Spanish. Yeah, like because the Spanish people brought calendars and numbers. Mm. So the way you pronounce the months, let's say, is very close to Spanish.
In Tahitian.
So, yes. There's a Tahitian language. And then I speak English because we learn it at school. And the Hakka is more like the family Hakka. And you can imagine it's not this really, it's not a good Hakka. Like, I think it's just evolved with time and the generation. So
it's like the Hakka that runs in the family.
Yes.
But not an actual Hakka.
And other families, even my cousin, I would try to tell them something and they'd be like, no, this is not how we say it. So everyone have a different version of each word. And when I used to try and talk to my grandma, she'd be like, what? And then I would have to repeat it in French. She's like, oh, okay, you just want to eat. Okay, so totally not good pronunciation at all.
That's
so
interesting. Yeah. But
that's it.
Normally your dominant language is French.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right, right.
Yes. And we learn a bit Spanish at school. So, but it's anyways easy for us, Spanish, Italian when we speak French. So
right. Yeah. That's really cool. But I mean, just out of curiosity, like, are there any like Tahitian phrases that you can quickly teach us?
Maeva means welcome.
Maeva.
Maeva, yeah.
Maeva.
Yes, there's a few vowels and sounds you don't have in Tahitian, like the F. But there's a, yeah, so it's really a cute language, but I'm really, once again, I don't want to teach you something wrong.
No, I'm just so curious.
Yeah.
So those are the languages that you speak, but of course later on you also left French Polynesia and you moved to France, right? You know, what prompted the move?
Oh, so we always go through our high school and then we leave usually to go to France or Canada or somewhere else to go to university, because Tahiti has a few universities, but there's not all the fields or industries that we want. So let's say architecture, I needed to leave and to study abroad. Yeah. And my sister was already anyway in France, so I just followed her.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so when you arrived in France, what was your first impression? Because like you grew up in French culture as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the worst thing is I grew up in French-American culture. Mm. And so arriving in France was so opposite of anything I knew. So all the culture, the singers, the, you know, politicians and all this. And, you know, yeah, they love talking about politics. And I was just like, huh, I really don't understand. And I'm not interested. So I ended up really teaming with a few Tahitians who were at the same university. And also some international students, to be honest. Like my best friend is actually Filipina Austrian.
Yeah. Wow.
So there was a few international students that were there, and like we're still like very, very good friends.
You know, obviously you mentioned when you're in France, people were telling you that you're Chinese.
Oh, yeah.
And then they were asking questions about like why you speak French.
Yeah.
And has anyone told you like, oh, your French is a little different?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, because like I think I'm only asking this because like there are some French speaking Canadians, mm-hmm. like who grew up in Canada, mm-hmm. and then when they moved outside Canada, and then when they started, you know, meeting more French people, right? And then French people would tell them that, oh, your French is not real French. Have you ever gone that?
Not that. I don't have a strong Tahitian accent, while others may have. But a lot, like even now, I would still have your French is perfect. Like, how did you learn French? Like, well, I speak French. Like, I'm French. My passport is French. Oh, really? So, yeah, I do get that a lot. Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. And, you know, like since you moved outside French Polynesia, that's when you met a lot more different people.
Yeah.
And that's when people would ask you different questions about your identity.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Why do you look the way that you do? Why you sound the way that you do, right? So I'm just wondering if there were any like culture shocks that you had interacting interacting with other Asians or when you eventually move to Asia?
Mm-mm. Well, this we could talk for hours about it. I have so many stories. Maybe so one was when I first visited China. It was Beijing after the Olympics, and people were staring at me because I looked, I guess, different. And I'm really tanned as well. So yeah, my skin is very dark. So either they were thinking, what is this country woman? What is this farmer doing here? But she's not dressed as a farmer. I don't know. You know, people have weird
I know, in thoughts. East Asian yes. beauty standards mm-hmm. is like they value
they want fairness. Skin. Yeah, yeah, so I have the whole list of chapter about the stories about this and how, yeah, even my coworkers were like, Katie, don't go in the sun. You don't look pretty. And things like that. Like I would just, but it's, we're so used to it.
Yeah.
But
we grew up in the sun.
But then when I would fly back home and they'd be like, Katie, you're so white. You need to go to the beach. Like we're going right now. Like we had 20 hours flight. We don't care. You go to the beach now. So it's like, okay, where do I fit in? You know, it was crazy. And then people would start to reject my answers. They'll be like, oh, where are you from? And I would say, I'm French. And they'll be like, no, you're not French. And I'll be like, okay, I'm Chinese. No, you're not Chinese either. So I remember there was one guard of my building. He kept bugging me about where I'm from. And then he was like, one day I came home and he's like, I know it. You're Vietnamese. I was like, no, I don't think so. I'm fully, you know, I know my parents and all this is like, okay, your grandmother is Vietnamese.
Oh, dear.
And they want to impose, you know, their answer and they want to be right. And I just laugh about it now, but it's a lot.
It's so weird why people do that.
They reject it, right?
Because like, you know, like when they meet a new person and when the person is basically breaking all the labels or like, you know, like whatever the person represents, it's not something that they know.
Yeah.
That's when they will start giving you labels that they are familiar with.
Totally.
And it's just crazy to think that coming from like a complete stranger, he would be in a position telling you that your grandma is Vietnamese. I was like,
But I just laugh about it in the end. So yeah, you can only laugh about it. And I know I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people who are also that happen to be in your podcast as well, who have very different origins and they're just everyone is so confused about us. Yeah.
But do you think, you know, like from your observation, right? Mm. Like how people would tell you what you are, does it happen more often in Asia or it doesn't really matter? Like everywhere you go, people do that as well.
Asia, definitely. Also because I've been here quite a few years and also Asians are so straightforward and no filters, so they would tell
like,
you exactly.
Got fat.
Yeah, exactly.
You're too skinny.
You look terrible. So yes, we do get that. But the good thing is, whenever I travel in Southeast Asia, I'm never targeted. Like I'm never a tourist. So I love it. I just go with the locals. I can just blend in. I just love it. I feel like I'm blending in many many places. Yeah. In the end, that's the good thing of it.
That's nice.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, it's amazing to think that even, you know, within the Asian communities, like there are so many different types of people. Yeah. And within Asia, there are also like pockets of communities where, you know, a lot of diverse cultures that exist and there's so much to be explored. Mm-hmm. But I mean, going back to your career as an interior designer, because obviously, eventually the career that you picked for yourself is interior design. So I'm wondering, how did it all start for you? When did you have the idea of wanting to become an interior designer?
Yeah. Okay, I never had that idea. But I'm really glad I did.
Was it an accident? Happened.
Maybe. So I study civil engineering and architecture. So that's two masters. And then I realized, wow, engineering is really not my thing. Like I finished the masters, but then I was like, I did an internship and I didn't like it. It was just not my, you know, passion, right? And so I did a year out in a design firm, in architecture firm in Hong Kong. And it was really fun because we got to design a lot of third tier cities in China. And so at this time, developers and the governments were bidding to have land and to have the permit from the government. The developers needed to show beautiful buildings and towers and how green and sustainable their development would be. Mm-hmm. So we were designing for them, and it would be just all day designing beautiful things. And it was just really cool. Yeah. So when you're just a fresh grad and you have the choice of designing a parking in France, you know, that you would do that for like 2 years. And you get to design a 20 tower development every 2 months. I just went for Asia, you know, for Hong Kong, because it would never end. And even as a fresh graduate, they would give us the opportunity to work on your own projects. So it was just amazing. So that was really the start of my design sort of career. And then I got an opportunity to work in Malaysia for a developer, so in-house. And when you're in-house, they have to make you work, you know. So in-house, so I was the only designer in-house. So I had to overlook at urban planning, their architecture projects, but also their interiors. And that's really when I started understanding that it was very basic, you know, materials and layouts and flow. But it was really interesting because we had to work also with marketing team to make sure that, let's say, the shopping mall had some anchor points and good F&B, or think about what would attract people to go to their mall, because KL has so many good malls. So we would just like go to other malls and do our, you know, research, but we'll just sit at cafes and like, you know, enjoy it. That's also part of understanding design. It's about experiencing the place yourself and just picking what you like or don't like, and then trying to understand what the concept of the space is. And then you just can apply it elsewhere.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, it sounds so difficult to become a good interior designer. No, yourself.
I tried to make it sound really easy.
Because you're mentioning it kind of required knowledge about, you know, of course there's science behind it, you know, the engineering side of it. But at the same time, there's also, you know, you mentioned architecture. There's a bit of human psychology as well, right? Like how people work with 100%. The spaces, their preferences.
Yes.
You know, what it takes to create a space that's welcome. To people. Want to spend time there. Right.
I never thought about saying it's about human psychology, but yeah, I think it is about we always put the end user in mind anyway, and it's us as well. Like, would we want to sit here, you know, would we enjoy the space ourselves? And if we do, then is the way to go.
I mean, sometimes it's like it's the minor things, you know, on your daily life when you somehow come across, you know, maybe like a bench in the public space, or like a chair, and then somehow it fits comfortably like with your body. That's why I was like, oh, wow, this is good design. Sometimes it's like good design is you just don't notice it.
Yes,
it just fits right in.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
That sounds like rocket science to me. But of course, you also worked on some really cool projects. Eventually, you worked as the principal architect of Soho House, which is a private members club. And you were the one behind Soho House Hong Kong. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. We were, so as in-house, so Soho House does all their design in-house. So I was one of the architects working on Hong Kong and also Mumbai. That's where I went to India. The Hong Kong house is very, very special because it's the first house that was stacked, the first sort of tower. Usually Soho House inserts itself in grade one buildings. You know, they have beautiful colonial buildings and architecture, but this one was just curtain, you know, glass tower. And people were really like, how are you going to make this? Turn this into a Soho House. So it was interesting to see how we could stack the programs and still make it look cozy and warm. A few things about it was, first of all, we really wanted to integrate Southeast Asian design in the mid-century modern British interiors. And that we did it with a lot of use of rattan and bamboo and cane from, you know, the design team in London. And our challenges here in Hong Kong was to basically source and find all these materials, but also the workmanship. In Europe, you would say, I want an aged finish. And in Asia, in Hong Kong, they'd be like, why would you want it aged? Like, it's beautiful. It needs to be shiny. It needs to be reflecting, you know, reflective and high gloss. So they wouldn't get the aged finish of material. So we had around 300 different materials. So yeah, there was a long process about trying to find the right partners, the right makers, the right sources. And in the end, it went fine. But we eventually had to fly carpenters in to age the wood. There's a particular way to do it. And we had to make the banquettes, like things where we're sitting, they were made in London. In the UK, and wow, fly the banquettes in. So this project was a lot of logistics as well.
I remember the first time that I visited Soho House Hong Kong, mm-hmm, which was kind of a long time ago now. Like, I was so impressed because like you mentioned, from the outside, it looks like a normal office building, a skyscraper, mm-hmm, one of the skyscrapers in Hong Kong. But once you enter the space, you were instantly transported to a completely different world. Mm-hmm. And every corner that you look at, there was something to look at.
Yeah.
And I love how you guys also basically connected all the floors, mm-hmm, with a set of staircase, right? Yeah. And then also one of the signature features of Soho House, or Soho Houses Anywhere, is there's a pool. So can you tell us more about how you worked the pool into a skyscraper? That it wasn't even a rooftop.
You know, there's a little bit, that was tricky because the building was almost completed before they signed the lease. So we had to make amendments while, you know, finishing the superstructure. And one of them was, how can we have a pool? So we had to work out, are we going to put it on the roof? Are we going to cut the roof open? And in the end, it turned up that we could just have that size of a pool that you saw, and with a very shallow pool because of the weight of the water. Like, water weighs so much. Mm. It wasn't safe to put, you know, such a crazy size pool. And this is why it got reduced to that size. Yeah.
And it turned out to be a very, like, interesting.
Yeah, totally. Like, we ended up saying, I'm putting it still, like, we still need a pool bar. Okay. Like, there's no way we open a house without a pool. But it ended up being like our disco floor, club floor, and people just like using it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a disco ball dangling.
Yes. Yes.
Above the pool.
Yeah. Totally.
I've never had a dip in the pool myself yet.
The disco ball came only, so a lot of the design ideas were also added on by the design manager, Marcus Bowell, or the CEO himself, Nick Jones. So they would come to Hong Kong and be like, I want a disco ball here, or I want this here and that. And then we would have to change it. But a lot of their ideas were really extraordinary. Like, it makes Soho House what it is.
Did it take from start to finish for you?
I think a year. We were slightly delayed, don't say it. Well, a year ish
a year only, and it was
started really before it's the design started before the I know they spent before I joined the team, they spent a lot of time working on the building, and like I said, make sure the pool was there, etc. So yeah, that's a really long project. The contractors thought they were coming in for 6 months maybe, but because of the complexity of, you were saying, like, every corner there's a detail, so it needed more time. Yeah,
a lot of problems to be solved as well.
Yes, correct.
And another project that you worked on, we are currently sitting in it. We're filming from this space that you created for a Cantonese themed bar in Hong Kong. So can you tell us more about this space that we are currently in?
So I'm really, really proud to have designed Kinsman. So this is a cocktail bar. We're on 65 Peel Street right now. And its co-founder is sitting next to us, so we'll try to say really nice thing about
it. Shout out to Gavin, who was previously on the Proudly Asian show as well. So if you have not checked out the episodes, go listen to it.
Yes, it's a must. Yeah. No, so when Gavin reached out to me, he had this very clear idea of what he wanted. And that was already like 50% of the work, because he knew exactly what he wanted. He had a clear vision. He wanted a space that would transport us to In the Mood for Love and the whole old Hong Kong spaces and atmosphere. Like the vibe and atmosphere was the most important, no matter what we would do with it. So he had a few design features he really wanted to have, such as the mural at the back bar, that actually was one of the focus point, the bar. And that's also our start point, because from the bar, we kind of knew how we would want people to enter. There was a sequence. We would want people to come through the foyer and feel like, okay, we're almost like in the back alley, you know, in this, In the Mood for Love, in the movie. A lot of the scenes happen outside in this back street. So we wanted it to be an indoor-outdoor. Mm. And then we enter and we kind of have a glimpse through the windows, and we see a bar and touches of color and red. And then after that, we see the seatings, and we wanted to also give intimacy to each of the guests, because this bar was really important to have, to sit down and enjoy the drinks. These very refined cocktails that Gavin designed, right? So it's all about the user experience and how we wanted them to evolve in the space and not feel stuck, or not feel like there's only one way to enjoy the space. There's like as many ways as many people.
As we look around, like, and also on my first visit to Kinsman as well, what really stood out to me was this bar is very well lit, but then not overly bright. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, personally, I don't really like bars that are really dark.
Yeah.
So what stood out to me was that this bar is so warm and welcoming, spacious, and I feel safe, you know, enjoying my cocktails here. So I'm wondering if it was also part of the consideration, you know, that went into the lighting and, you know, the airiness of the space.
We always try to have layers. So for any element in fabric, in seatings, and in lighting. So definitely we wanted to have dim lights, so the ceiling lights, but then we would create some different levels. So we have a pendant here. Gavin actually sourced it. It's a vintage acrylic pendant. And then we have table lamps here, so some portable ones and some on the bar itself. And the important thing is the wall sconces. So the wall lights that you see here, they would create different, like I said, like levels. And that's how you feel really wrapped in a very, you know, warm atmosphere.
Cozy.
Because it's not coming just from top to down where we would look horrible,
it
you know,
be intimidating.
Yes, exactly. You'd be like, what do you want to eat? And then we know that table lamp is super key, because we don't want to eat or drink and not see what we're eating.
Exactly.
Right? And then the fact that it's warm white, we have our specific light bulbs that we use that we know we're happy with, and everything, it's very, in the end, it's like a lot of details behind lighting, for sure.
And currently we are also sitting at pretty much the focal point of the bar as well. So how did you come up with this circular booth concept?
I think it was about our first understanding of the concept, which was a lot of, like, there's this scene on the sitting booth, right, in mm-hmm. the store, in the movie. And so this circular one came because we are in the corner and we wanted to symbolize kinsmen, which is togetherness. So the concept that Gavin had is that it's a togetherness around drinks, that we form relationships that are not just always love or family, but it's also to share a passion or enjoyment of something. So that's really a symbol of it here.
Yeah, yeah. And I've come here multiple times and I'm always constantly so amazed by how many people can fit in this circular booth,
because tiny, like, Asians.
It looks tiny, but then this space just keeps on giving. Like, we have fit like 9 to 10 people.
Great. In this
booth. And the other question I want to ask about the space that you designed is obviously the materials. Mm-hmm. And because, like, just from the look of it, we see a lot of different finishes and materials. So I'm wondering, like, what was the process that went into sourcing all of these materials that might also honor the old Hong Kong and the local culture?
Uh-huh. So in terms of, we always start with a base. So we were going for red, you know, and so that was a go-to for the sitting booth anyways. And then there's to balance this very bright color, we wanted a softer finish for the walls. So we picked this very pale pink. It's actually a polished plaster, and that's a slight satin finish. So you see there's a slight reflection. It's not 100% matte. Mm. And then we also went for walnut, which is like a key wood of the mid-century modern style. And obviously antique brass as well, that's pairs with walnut really well.
Yeah. And also some glass panels that are quite specific to Hong Kong, right?
Yes. So the texture glass that we see in even like Cha Cha Tang or in the different buildings facade sometimes. So we picked some transparent and some, you know, texture, so you would see the light through, but not fully like see the other person sitting behind you.
Wow. That's genius.
Yeah. So tinted glass was really important as well. And we picked a green to really go with also the 60s kind of mood. If you've been to the bathroom, they're all in this olive green color. We wanted a monochrome theme for the bathroom. Like, you enter and it's totally different. And also one particular element that I like, and I put in a few of my projects, I'm obsessed with glass bricks, so that I don't know if you notice on top of the door.
Oh yeah.
So you see so you have the entrance door, the windows, and you have the glass blocks.
Yeah.
And these are specific of the modern design. And actually in this building next door, you have the entrance of the building itself, and the staircase is lit by glass blocks. So in Hong Kong, in the mid-century modern, they use glass bricks a lot to let the light shine in, but not having full transparency. So when you look at this facade, you actually, if you go outside, you will see the glass block. So that's what we wanted to remind here. It's a little like hint of like, hey, you know, we're part of this building and we're inside and outside at the same time.
Yeah. And also, you know, as a visitor of the bar myself, what I really liked as well is like, it's quite functional because like where the bar is, under the bar table, you also added some hooks for people to hook their bags. Yeah. So I love how not only did you make this such a, you know, like visually pleasing space, but also a very functional, multi-purpose space where, you know, it would allow people to have gatherings, parties, live music and different functions as well. So that's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. We always, like I said, we always think of end users, and we like going to bars ourselves. So we'd be like, what would we like? And there's nothing more annoying than not knowing where to put your purse.
Exactly.
You know, so this in the bathrooms as well, we always put hooks. These are such tiny details, but they matter.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, at the end of the day, like, whether or not, is this a cha chan tang? Is this a bar or a bar that looks like cha chan tang?
Yeah.
You all have to come to Kinsmen whenever you're in Hong Kong to find out. Not only do they have amazing Cantonese inspired cocktails that use Cantonese and Chinese spirits, they also have some Cantonese desserts like tong so and also Cantonese snacks like curry squid. You know,
and
shrimp
tried
toast.
I tried them all.
I think I actually ordered all of the menu and I was, this is, I gotta say, I mean, I'm not saying this because I'm filming here, but this is the first bar that impressed me with every single item on their menu. And I mean, at this age, I'm not a big drinker myself, whenever I need to drink or whenever I have a gathering that involves
alcohol. You want something
alcohol,
meaningful, like, yes. And it's like good quality and you feel like it's not just any sort of alcohol you like.
Exactly. Like
really
in this beautiful
it.
Space that's also proudly Asian.
Oh, so proudly Asian. Yes.
And before we move on to the next segment, I'm also wondering, you know, like for those of our listeners who are interested in pursuing a career in interior design, I'm wondering if you have any advice for them.
Oh, many. Well, as I said, just try to design for yourself but also end users. Be very observant of spaces and materials, and whatever you visit you will know how to use it you know, in some of the other design problematics that you meet. Of course there's a lot of hard work. This it just never ends, you know. When we have a bar to open, we have a set date. We target to open, to have a soft opening. Nothing needs, like whatever comes in, we have to address it to make sure that we open it on the right, you know, day. And so it's really, it can be really intense, but that's also part of the, you know, the work itself. And just have fun, because it's, if you're having fun in your work, you know, it doesn't feel like you're tired or painful. It's just, you know, very enjoyable. And I think you can feel it, that in this bar, we've had a lot of fun designing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like it requires a lot of common sense. To make a good interior designer as well, right?
Yeah. I think it's more try not to copy things. You know, it's not just a very methodological formula of like what makes it a good design. It's more how you feel and understanding the site itself, what's around. Like I said, we looked at the building from outside and what could we bring inside, you know, or how is the light hitting the seating booth here and how can we make use of these windows? Just very briefly, you know, talking about the site itself. But yes, that
it's
would
sort
be
of
it.
Like storytelling in a way as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But now it's time for us to move on to the next segment, which is called
Rapid Fire.
That's going to be fun.
Yes. In this segment, I'll be asking my guests biased questions that they've got asked at some point in life. Mm-hmm. And for Katty's case, it could be questions about her cultural identity, where she's from, which is French Polynesia. So, Katty, are you ready?
Yeah. For the thousandth time in my life.
Yes, you're well trained for it, yes. I guess. All right, let's go. First question. You say you're French, but you're not really French, are you?
Yes, I'm French. My passport is French. Yes.
I mean, there's no other answer for it.
Yeah.
And the second question is, you say you're Chinese, but you're not really Chinese, are you?
And that's when I say, well, I'm sort of fourth generation Chinese, but I'm French. So the way I found the best answer right now in Hong Kong is I have to say I'm French Chinese, even if it's not really true. Like you're like, okay, genetically or culturally, right? It's just, there's never one answer to that. So if I say French Chinese, they kind of let me live with it. You know how I was saying, like, people would just not be happy.
Maybe
about
they would
my
stop
answer.
Listening yeah. after you say French. Oh, she's okay, French. She's French, a foreigner.
Yeah, so they would just let me be. So French Chinese it is. Yeah.
Wow. So I mean, I guess in Hong Kong, if you tell them you're Chinese, they'll be like, no, you're not, yes, like, because they don't speak Chinese.
Exactly, and they don't understand why I don't speak. And in mainland China, when I visited, people would get really, really mad at me because I would go in a taxi and I'd be incapable to say where I want to go, or I don't know how I was planning to say. And they would really like insult me and think either I'm making fun, or they would just think I'm wasting their time. People get really upset that I can't speak.
Yes, I mean, I've definitely heard people saying like, oh, you're Chinese, you should speak Chinese. And the third question. Now, since you're French Chinese, is your mom French or your dad is French?
That one. So they do, they just can't figure it out. So then I'm like, which part of you? So then I say, what do I say? It changes. I also have fun, you know, when I answer. I'm just like, yeah, okay, that's my dad. My dad is Chinese. Then as I look at them and I'm like, okay, when are they letting me, you know, when are they going to stop this conversation?
Yeah.
So the conversation stopper is at some point I said yes to any question and I'm just moving on. Otherwise, like, it would never end.
Because sometimes they are looking for that one keyword or one label. That's what
labels, exactly. You know, labels.
Like, makes sense.
Because I can't explain to everyone, okay, I'm fourth generation, Hakka. But it helps to say sometimes, okay, I'm Hakka, you know, and I just grew up in France. That's it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The kind of like narratives and stories you have to adopt just so you make sense.
Adopt and adapt. Always.
Adapt. Yes.
Adapt to the audience.
That's right. Yeah. And the fourth question. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about the earthquake. How is your family?
Around that time where Haiti got hit by an earthquake, it was, and still I still have it sometimes, that comment. And then I'm like, oh, it's okay, I come from Tahiti. So then I'm like, my family's okay, they're in Tahiti.
But I guess they still wouldn't know.
Sometimes they realize and I'm like, oh, okay, I thought it's Haiti. Or sometimes they wouldn't understand. They wouldn't realize and they'd be, just done.
And the next question. I heard there is a lot of violence in your hometown. Is it true?
Yeah. So sometimes I just say, oh, I'm going back home, you know, for Christmas. And they're like, oh, is it really dangerous? And then I'm just... It's sort of dangerous, but it's not. So I'm like, it's okay. But then they go really like, I heard really bad thing. People get killed. I'm like, wait a minute.
It's like, where are you referring to?
Where do you think? So, and then I said, oh no, it's actually Tahiti. And I'm sorry. I thought it was Haiti. Couple of times.
Wow.
It's okay.
Wow, I did not know people would mix them both up.
Yeah, me neither.
And the next question is, I guess you get this a lot. Mm-hmm. So where did you learn French? You speak so well.
Yes. I said, I'm French. Yeah. But actually, recently, people have just said, oh, are you French? And I said, yeah. They said, how do you know? And they said that I have a French accent, which is crazy. Do I have a French accent? Not so strong.
A hint of it, but not the strongest.
Exactly.
I've come across.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People say I have. Well, anyway, people.
It's like people would only see and hear what they want to see and hear. Mm-hmm. And the last question. This is a very odd one.
Weird.
Does your boss pay your rent?
Yeah. That needs context, actually. So it was one of my first years in Hong Kong, and I was living in Kennedy Town by myself, and my work was in Wan Chai in my design office. So every morning I bump into that person in the lift and he's like, oh, morning. So I'm like super happy, you know, really nice. He says good morning, and he always asks questions like, where do you go to work, blah, blah, blah. So I say Wan Chai. Okay, another day is like, so is your boss paying you for your rent? And then I'm like, why would my boss pay for my rent? Should I walk to work, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, maybe I should talk to HR. Like, should they
do bosses pay for your rent here?
I didn't know about And then really only months or years later that I realized that he was actually thinking I'm from Philippines, or I work in Wan Chai as either a domestic helper or any of these biased categories. Like, And now, then I got really shocked and I was like, oh my God, he actually, you know, he was making it as an assumption, because I really thought my boss had to pay my rent.
That would be nice.
Yeah, yeah, I was about to ask him.
Yeah, wow.
That's crazy though, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of crazy to think how in Hong Kong, there are a lot of people who tend to, when they come across an Asian person, with like tan skin, yeah, that's when they would assume, oh, you must be a domestic helper.
Totally.
And there's so much like negative connotation around the label of domestic helper in Hong Kong, but it's just a normal job.
Exactly.
So I'm not really sure why people have to discriminate.
Yes, and look down on them. Yeah. And on me. Yeah. So Wan Chai was a little bit like, I love Wan Chai and work there. And I realized that if I'm there, I'm put a label on, you know, like I'm a
dip, would
like
think
they
you
would assume
worked
something
at
else.
A bar.
Yeah. And I dress normal, right? Okay. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't like dressed weird or something.
There's like one, I mean, just to clarify for our listeners who are not from Hong Kong, like there's one street in Wan Chai where there are a lot of bars, which is kind of the red light district, a little bit like that. Yeah, but there are also many different neighborhoods or like communities in Wan Chai. There are like normal office areas. And I remember there's a street that's full of furniture stores as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And hardware and materials. Yeah.
Well, anyway, Cathy, thank you so much for going through this round of rapid bias with us.
Thank you. It's okay.
All right.
I'm exhausted.
Have a glass of water. And now for us to conclude the episode. Mm-hmm. For those who would like to check out your work, follow your upcoming projects, where can they find you? And are there any upcoming projects that you're excited about that you can also tell us about on the show?
So we have a website. It's atelier/ how do you call this one?
Hyphen.
Hyphen. Shan.com.
We need to make sure. Is it actually? We'll link Cathy's IG handle in the.
That's one of the words I can't translate. But anyway, we have a website. We also have an Instagram account. Mm-hmm. So it's also Atelier Shan. And then our office is in Wan Chai. I go back to Wan Chai. So they can also visit us. We're on Queens Road East. And then we're working on some interesting projects. There's a rooftop bar in Indonesia that I'm really excited about. It might open mid of this year. And potentially some other projects coming along in Indonesia. Yeah. Otherwise, we're working on some residential projects in Hong Kong and one of my clients' office in Boston as well. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's really fun.
Wow. This job just takes you all over the world.
Oh, we're not flying there. Okay. But Indonesia, we might,
Most of the design work is remote.
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah, Indonesia. Well, when we can, we would go there, but otherwise we're so busy that it's trying to also like be more efficient, right? If we can, we've been having a lot of like Zoom calls and meetings on Zoom, and it's been going really well. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to seeing more
of your
creations.
Yes,
I'm sure they all will look amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And before we go, I just have one last question for you, Cathy. To you, what does it mean to be proudly Asian?
Well, it's very nice to be with you on this podcast, because it's something that I didn't, like I said, address when I was younger or teenager, and maybe things would have been different, like experienced differently, if I kind of had more thoughts about it or more connected to people who were in the similar with a similar story or just were different, right? So to me, it was also important to be on this podcast to like reach out to others who might be like that as well. And I'm super proud of all my Asian sides, like the good and the bad sides. And like, I'm really annoying to my husband who's British, because I have so many weird Asian habits. I'm obsessed with food and I always need to have food in my bag and I need to drink hot water and all of these things.
And rice.
And rice. Rice needs to be cooked in a rice cooker, otherwise it's not real rice. So yeah, we laugh a lot about this. But I'm really grateful that my parents taught us like some really good, some really interesting traditions about us, our culture, whether it's Hakka or Chinese or Tahitian. So that's this, is being proud of who you are as you are, right? Even if you're different. So I really hope to also give this pride to my daughters, you know, to my family, and that they grow really, proud and happy for who they are. Yeah.
Love it. And yeah, with you sharing your story with us, maybe a little girl in Tahiti, Asian, maybe they're like, oh, maybe she will now realize she's not the only one.
Yeah. Because I mean, people are so cool now. So I'm like, they'd be like, oh, who is this not cool person talking about?
But right, it's always nice to hear from like different people about their lived experiences. And even if two people are from the same place, they can have completely different experiences as well. Mm-hmm. So it's always lovely to hear, you know, from different people about,
you
know, how they experienced their cultures, their heritage and the places that they grew up in. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
on
you so
Cali
much.
Asia.
It was really fun. Yeah, I really enjoyed sharing this moment with you here.
That's it for this episode of Proudly Asian. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at proudly.asian for more content. We are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Leave us a 5-star review on wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in and signing off for now. I'm Isabel Wong.